Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Palestinians slam as collective punishment the Israeli move to close the only crossing for Palestinian workers coming from the Gaza Strip. President Zelensky warns Kyiv will pull out of talks with Moscow if Ukrainian soldiers hold up at a vast steelworks in Mariupol or killed by Russian troops. And France prepares to choose a new president on Sunday in a showdown between incumbent Emmanuel Macron and far-right challenger Marine Le Pen following a bitterly polarizing campaign. Hello and welcome. We are coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. Israel says it's closing the only crossing for Palestinian workers coming from the Gaza Strip. Palestinians denounce the move as collective punishment. The regime says the closure is in response to alleged airstrikes conducted by the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. Palestinian Workers Union in Gaza criticized the measure, saying it hurts the area's already suffering economy. Hamas officials have also slammed the move as a form of unacceptable aggression aimed at tightening the siege on Palestinians. The resistance's spokesperson told the media that such collective punishments against Palestinians have always proved to fail. Author and Middle East expert Kevin Barrett says Israeli measures against Palestinians fit the very definition of genocide. Stick with it.
These 2 million people are packed into 140 square miles. It's the most densely populated zone on Earth. And the Zionists have essentially locked it down and maintained this siege for 15 years now, choking off food and medical supplies and basically, you know, measuring the calories so they can theoretically sort of barely keep everyone alive but without any surplus. So this is an ongoing human rights atrocity. It fits the definition of genocide. Well, the larger war on the Palestinian people fits that definition according to various scholars of international law. And this crackdown on the current exit of Gaza, preventing people from working, is probably going to just lead to a more tit-for-tat escalation. And it seems that the Zionists are seeking that because they've attacked the Masjid al-Aqsa during the holy month of Ramadan and engaged in other provocations over in the occupied West Bank. So it does seem that for whatever reasons, they're in that part of their cycle where they're trying to ramp up tensions and create problems.
People are taking to the streets across the world in solidarity with Palestinians facing intensifying Israeli crackdown. Rallies were held in European capitals such as Amsterdam, London, and Berlin. The protesters called for international action, including sanctions, to end the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories and the regime's growing aggression. More weekend protests have been planned in other countries worldwide, including the U.S., Australia, and Canada. The situation has recently been tense in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, with Israeli forces and settlers storming the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Hundreds of Palestinians have been injured in the ensuing attacks. The violence has drawn international condemnation, with some countries summoning Israeli ambassadors to protest against the regime's violations. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, who has been following the intensified Israeli crackdown against Palestinian worshippers. Let's see what she had to say.
Well, it's the holy month of Ramadan, and Palestinians here in the occupied territories prefer to go to Al-Quds and to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. However, Israelis, as usual, continue to put strict measures. Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank are not allowed to enter Al-Quds without Israeli-issued permits, and it's almost impossible for Palestinians to get. The Israelis claim that they gave Palestinians some east, let's say, the measures for the Palestinians in order to enter Al-Quds. However, this was not true. Men over the age of 40 were allowed to enter, women as well on Fridays. However, many Palestinians, hundreds of them, were returned back to their cities and their towns when they arrived at the number of military checkpoints that separate between the West Bank and Al-Quds. This is not only the case, and even the people of Al-Quds, the residents of Al-Quds themselves, they were banned from entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque, especially Palestinian youths and those under the age of 30.
The Ukrainian president warns that talks with Russia might break down depending on Moscow's demands and actions.
Yeah. If Russia destroys our people and the city of Mariupol, if there are pseudo-referendums in pseudo-republics, Ukraine will quit the process of negotiations.
In a news conference held in the capital Kyiv's metro system, Volodymyr Zelensky said it's now up to his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, to decide if the Turkey peace talks can continue. Zelensky also said it's vital for Ukraine to obtain more weapons. He announced that U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken and Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin will travel to his country on Sunday for talks. Delivery of American-made weapons to Ukraine will be on the agenda. Peace talks between Ukraine and Russia kicked off a few days after the war broke out in late February. They have so far failed to make a breakthrough. Researcher Greg Simons says Zelensky's suggestion that Russia plans to capture other countries too is just an attempt to provoke them into getting involved in the Russia-Ukraine war.
Ukraine is staring a military defeat in the face. So what this is, it's, as rightly noted, it's a fear-based appeal, not to Ukrainians, but more widely Europe and anyone else that would listen, because obviously the propaganda and the weapon supplies alone are insufficient to halt the Russian advance. So this is an appeal based on fear that something bad can happen in an invasion, and that something bad can happen to them, an invasion to these countries, whoever they may be, because he doesn't name them. And so people are more likely to react emotionally than logically and dismiss this. This is what the attempt is. So he's trying to get a direct involvement of other countries into the Ukrainian conflict. This is the intention of the appeal.
After a bitter and divisive election campaign, France is preparing to vote for its president for the next 5 years. A runoff ballot pits centrist President Emmanuel Macron against far-right challenger Marine Le Pen. Opinion polls suggest a re-election for pro-European Macron. He won the first round by nearly 28% of the vote, while anti-immigrant Le Pen came in second with just over 23%. The turnout was down 4% from the last election, with voters somewhat disenchanted by choice of candidates. In 2017, Macron beat Le Pen with over 66% of the vote. Macron seeks to become the first French president to win re-election in two decades. A Le Pen victory would make her modern France's first far-right leader and first female president. She seeks to capitalize on public dissatisfaction with the incumbent's economic policy. Purchasing power is voters' top concern, following a huge increase in energy prices and rising inflation. Polls will open at 600 GMT on Sunday. Official results will trickle in through the evening.
France's presidential campaign has concluded, and the nation is set to vote on April 24th. After a debate in which Marine Le Pen didn't attack Emmanuel Macron's controversial record, the final polls have Macron leading by around a 54-46% margin. That's beyond the margin of error, but 30% of voters say they still haven't made up their minds. That means a Le Pen victory appears unlikely, but would not be surprising. Across the country, anti-fascist protests were held against Le Pen, although both candidates employ regular xenophobia and are economic neoliberals.
What voters should do is not be scared and rejoin the yellow vests. We have lost our purchasing power, our social services, our individual freedoms. Stop crying about these two candidates from behind your television or computer and come join us.
The anti-government yellow vests marched nationwide again, and many had strong words for their biggest nemesis, Macron.
The yellow vests are not likely to vote for Macron, that's for sure. They'll vote for Le Pen or submit a blank ballot. The yellow vests truly represent all levels of France, and what we all want is more participation in our democracy at all levels.
Not only is abstention expected to be the highest since 1969, but over 15% of the country may purposely submit a blank or spoiled ballot. That means almost half the electorate could refuse to submit a valid vote, in an expression of just how many won't be happy no matter which candidate prevails. Exit polls are not allowed to be published in France until the results are unveiled.
The initial results, which have never been wrong in France, are scheduled to be released at 1800 Greenwich Mean Time. A major protest is planned in Paris to begin at 1801 Greenwich Mean Time.
Sri Lankan government loyalists are calling on the Prime Minister to quit as protest pressure keeps mounting over a worsening economic crisis. Media Minister Nalaka Godahiwa and other senior party members demand the resignation of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa and his brother, Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa. The media minister also called for the resignation of the entire cabinet for an all-inclusive interim government to take over. Godahiwa says the government lost its credibility after the police killing of a protester on Tuesday. The president has already sacked three cabinet members, but protesters say these cosmetic changes are not enough. The island nation is in the grip of its worst ever economic crisis, with people facing power cuts and shortages of food, fuel, and medicine. The situation has ignited protests, with angry demonstrators camping outside the presidential office for over 3 weeks. Multiple bomb attacks on Hazara community in Afghanistan have left dozens of families in great sorrow. The relatives of the victims call for justice and an end to the violence. Rahmatullah Bahman reports from Kabul.
Recent deadly attacks in Afghanistan have left Afghan families grieving. Some have lost their parents and some their children. Here, we are meeting the family of Shahid Milad, who was killed in Tuesday's school bombing in Kabul. Milad's mother can't speak, as she is in a flood of tears, mourning the loss of her young son. But his disabled father managed to speak with great sorrow.
Milad was a very diligent boy. It was his last year at school. He was preparing himself to enter university. He used to tell me that he was going to become a doctor and make a living so that his father doesn't have to work. He wished to serve his family and society, but unfortunately they took him from us.
In another alley in Hazara neighborhood, another family is mourning the death of a father. After the attack on the school students, Mir Hussain went to bring his son home, but he himself fell victim to the second explosion.
My brother was on the roof when he heard a bomb explosion at the school. He quickly went to school to find his son Mahdi. He was searching around when the second explosion occurred. He was injured in the attack, but later at the hospital, we lost him forever.
Mahdi has survived the attack, but he is struggling with the shock of the attack and the pain of losing his father.
چرا متاثر میشه به خاطر که اول اگه مکتب شروع شه ده او که پشتیبان نداشته باشه چرا که مکتب بولی همی که نداشته باشه چرا که مکتب بولی بازار که نداشته باشه چرا که مکتب بولی این وضعیت هر کسی که باشه فیر که در مکتب میه در مکتب مردم در حال درس خوندن می در مکتب صنفای نمیگه صنف چند است خورد ریزه است یا کلانه میدن انفجار میکنه نفر میکشه گناه ازا چی است.
Likewise, in the west of Kabul, there are many families whose beloved ones are either killed or wounded. They feel despaired and can't hold back their tears. It remains to be seen if the time can heal their wounds. These days, Afghan families want peace and security. People here say they're terrified of repeated blind terror attacks. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Muslims are marking the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Ali, the first Shia Imam. Tens of thousands have descended on the holy shrine of Imam Reza in the northeastern Iranian city of Mashhad to commemorate the occasion. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Ali is one of the most adopted names among Muslims. This is because they have special love for Imam Ali, the first Imam of Shia Muslims. Now, to mark his martyrdom anniversary, thousands of Imam Ali's fervent followers have converged on the holy shrine of Imam Reza, who is one of his descendants. Members of this family have traveled all the way from Qatar to take part in the morning ceremonies in Mashhad. Imam Ali was the cousin of Prophet Muhammad and is hailed as the first man to embrace the Prophet's call for Islam. According to Islamic references, Imam Ali rooted out poverty and promoted an unprecedented justice system across the Muslim world during his short rule, based in Iraq city of Kufa. And that's why his character continues to inspire the younger generation, even today. Imam Ali was assassinated on the eve of the 20th day of the Islamic month of Ramadan in 661 AD. He was attacked with a poison-coated sword while he was praying in a mosque in Kufa. 2 days later, he succumbed to his wounds. Muslims erected a magnificent shrine for him in the Iraqi city of Najaf, which still draws pilgrims from across the Muslim world.
Shia Muslims have 12 imams, or religious leaders, with Imam Ali being the first. While all imams are equally revered among Shia Muslims, Imam Ali holds a special position as the father of Shia Islam and the symbol of Islamic justice. Yusuf Jalali from the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. Tonight might be the night of Qadr or the night of ordainment. The night of Qadr is the night of mercy, goodness, and blessing till the rising of dawn. It is the best night of year. According to narrations, the earth is filled with angels, and the fate of all creatures is determined for the next year. It was said in the previous episode that God suffices for meeting the needs of his servants. He has no associate or helper. He is omnipresent. He sees our deeds and is nearer to us from our jugular vein. But we often forget that we are in his presence. In order to understand that we are in God's presence, we need guides and leaders. These leaders intercede for us so that God pardons our sins and negligence and bestows his mercy and forgiveness upon us. Having a guide is the most important need for mankind. That's why God has met this need without our asking him. He sent prophets to remind people of God. In Ayah 21 of Surah Qashia, God tells the prophet, "So admonish, for you are only an admonisher." Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, called on the faithful in the last days of his life to cling to the Quran and his progeny, the Ahlul Bayt, to be immune from deviation. God has made the Prophet and the infallible Imams as a means between himself and the servants. He calls on servants in Ayah 56 of Surah Isra to seek recourse to their Lord, whoever is nearer to him. The Prophet called himself and Imam Ali as the fathers of this Ummah. So, clinging to the Prophet and the infallible Imams is a divine command. God says in Ayah 64 of Surah Nisa, "Had they, when they wronged themselves, come to you and pleaded to Allah for forgiveness, and the Apostle had pleaded for forgiveness for them, they would have surely found Allah all clement, all merciful." Taking recourse to the Prophet and the Imams never means associating anyone with God or considering them equal to God. It is very simple. Every house has a door, and to enter the house, one should open the door. To enter the divine throne, we should go through his good servants. God says in Ayah 189 of Surah Baqarah, "Come into houses from their doors and be wary of Allah so that you may be successful." Taking recourse to sanctities and good servants of God is not polytheism. Prophet Jacob's sons asked him to seek forgiveness for them, and he said he would soon plead with his Lord to forgive them. Moreover, Jacob put Joseph's shirt on his face and he regained his sight. Are objects superior to God's best servants? So, can the Prophet of Islam and his infallible successors not plead to God to solve people's problems? Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and his infallible successors, would recite the Quran at any time they could. It is narrated that when Imam Reza, peace upon him, reached ayahs that say, "O you who have faith," would say, "Labbaik, Allahumma labbaik." It means, "I answer your call, O God. I answer your call." Imam Reza was so much accustomed to the Quran that he used to recite it completely in 3 days. He said, "If I want it, I could finish it in less than 3 days. But I have never read an ayah except that I have reflected on it. And I thought on what issue and when the ayah had been revealed. Thus, I recite the Quran within 3 days. The eighth Imam says, on the virtues of the blessed month of Ramadan, "In the month of Ramadan, sins are forgiven. Recitation of one ayah of the Quran in this month is equal to recitation of the whole Quran in other month. Making brothers in faith happy causes happiness in the hereafter. And on the day when all feet will slip on Sirat Bridge, God will help him cross over the bridge. He who restrains his anger, God will keep his wrath away from him. If anyone helps an oppressed, God will preserve him from the enemies and on the day of judgment will help him in reckoning." Proper diet is very important in Ramadan. Glucose is saved in the liver and muscles. It is the main source of energy for the body. As the body receives no food for several hours in Ramadan days, first glucose is consumed, and once the body runs out of glucose, it is in the turn of fat. Therefore, fasting, in fact, gives a chance to the body to metabolize extra fat. The process of shifting the fuel from glucose to fat goes slowly. Hence, there is enough time for muscles to transform protein of foodstuffs into energy. The balance between food and liquid is very important in Ramadan. Although kidneys keep water and slats of the body, part of the water perishes through perspiration. In view of this, drinking juices and eating fruits is very useful as they are the source of fiber and help the individual tolerate thirst better. Fruits have water, vitamins, and minerals. So, after the iftar or breaking the fast, it is recommended to eat some fruit salad. The fiber in fruits is useful in destroying constipation, removal of poisons, and helps the digestive system and blood circulation. Fruits are digested easier than vegetables and help absorption of energy. Food for thought. Salam everybody and heartfelt condolences to you all on the tragic 21st of Ramadan, the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Ali, peace upon him, the divinely decreed vicegerent of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Here is part of his last will to all family members, friends, and followers. My advice to you is to be conscious of Allah and steadfast in your religion. Do not yearn for the world and do not be seduced by it. Do not resent anything you have missed in it. Proclaim the truth. Work for the next world. Oppose the oppressor and support the oppressed. Thank you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio This is your host Musa Al-Bahadili and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing In this program you will discuss issues, relevant questions and other fields regarding the Islamic upbringing of children and we would like to stress that the answers that we provide in this program are all based upon the narrations of the household of the Prophet and, of course, of the Prophet himself and upon the Holy Quran, supplemented with scientific research. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Ali Himani, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for joining us.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's my pleasure to be here in your studio.
Dear Sheikh, last time we spoke about this age, of the teenage age, and even the tweens phase, as you call it, when the children, they start to develop attractions to the opposite gender. Now, when we were talking about that, we also opened and discussed the subject of why is it that girls are more attached to their fathers, and also I think vice versa, perhaps, the fathers are more attached to the children, the girls, and why is it that sons are more attached to their mothers? Now, we mentioned some things about personalities, how the personalities opposites attract to a certain extent. But I feel that there might be more to this subject. So, dear Sheikh, please.
Let me start from the other side first, because it gives a good clarity here. Right. And then we will come to the children's side. If you look at the parents' side, that why is father more attached towards the daughter,
right,
is that the father knows that my son can protect himself, defend himself, take care of himself. However, somewhere deep down inside, the man does not have that confidence that my daughter can protect herself, take care of herself. Why? Because, right, again, a lot of daughters are sanguines, popular sanguines. So he notices their behavior in the house. He sees that, okay, she doesn't keep track of her books, she doesn't keep track of her shoes, she doesn't keep track of her clothes. Right. So she needs a protective figure.
He sees them as fragile.
Exactly. So right, I have to be there to protect her. I have to be there to take care of her. Now, being a father, being that macho and that aggressive and that, you know, strong personality, he can't express himself with that kind of authority in front of daughter. So with the daughter, being that strong personality, he acts, you know, nicely and fragile and, you know, patiently and caringly. And the daughter also likes that because at one end, she's getting all that care. On the other hand, she's feeling very secured and protected in the presence of the father. While she also notices that my mother, even my mother, when she wants protection, she goes to the father.
Right.
When she wants that support.
And comfort.
That shoulder and that courage, she goes to the father. So she learns from the mother that I need to get to the father for that protection, for that security.
Makes sense. Right.
So this is how it works. The father has that sense of responsibility to protect the daughter, and the daughter automatically looking at the mother feels that need that if I want to feel protected and safe, I need to get to my father, and he's the person who's going to protect me.
What about the mother's attachment to her sons then?
Sons. Now, keeping in mind that father is not at home all the time.
Right, yes.
Right. And this is where the mother looks at the son as the next best option to be that protector of the house. And then the son also finds that joy and finds that satisfaction of being the protector of the family at home. So a boy who reaches teenage, I don't know, if you look at some of the earlier movies, you know,
right,
like there was a movie, if I am not wrong, it was Mel Gibson. The name of the movie was Patriot. He had a son about 10 years old, and it was a war between the Redcoats and Whitecoats in America.
Right. The Civil War.
Yeah, right. The Civil War. So he heads out in the war, and he appoints his 10-year-old son.
You're the man of the house.
You're the man of the house.
Yes, we still have this in our culture.
Exactly.
You're the man of the house when I'm not present.
Exactly. And what does this mean? You're the man of the house. Means that you are going to be the protector of the house. And mother looks at the son as the protector. And this is where the son feels that courage.
But even a small child who's only like 1 year old, 2, 5. even at that age, the mother's like, he's my protector.
Yes, to some extent, yes. The mothers always look at their sons as those who are going to be the protectors of the family.
At least going to be in
going
the future.
To be. So right from that time, the mothers have a special attachment towards the son. And the son also gets all that love from the mother, which he doesn't get from the father. And that's why there's a special bond between the mother and the son here.
Let's continue this very intriguing conversation after a quick break.
Inshallah.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Sheikh, just before we went on a quick break, you mentioned the reason that a mother's more attached to her son is because she sees him as the protector of the family, or at least the future protector of the family. Correct. Now, Sheikh, is that always the case? Is that the sole reason why the mother is more attached to her son and why the father is more attached to his daughters?
Not necessarily. Rather, I would say the mother is more attached to all the children in a way, right, to a certain extent, equally, I would say. But somewhere, the son, being the son, has an upper hand compared to the girls in the house and can take care of a lot of chores, which are outdoor chores.
Right.
And that's where the mother, in a way, shows certain amount of dependency on the son.
She depends on the sons.
The son, and the son likes the fact that I have someone who trusts me, who depends on me.
I have responsibility.
I have responsibility. Right. She's treating me like a grown-up person, and he appreciates that, and he likes that environment, that I'm being treated like a man in, of the house every time my dad's not around. So, and that gives that confidence to the son. And therefore, these are some of the various reasons why there's this special bond and attachment between the son and the mother and the father and the daughter.
Right. Sheikh, let's circle back to our original topic, which was, now that we've spoken about this phase, about all of these attractions, naturally, when a child, he enters this teenage phase with all of the hormones and all of that stuff, which is natural, they start to view the opposite gender in a different light, in a different way. They start to develop attractions.
Correct.
Which we've mentioned before, it can lead to a disastrous and catastrophical result.
Correct.
As parents, and especially for parents who live in Western countries where it is much harder to manage their children and an Islamic lifestyle, what can they do to protect their children so that they may grow up and handle this phase, navigate this phase in an Islamic way which pleases Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
Correct. Like you pointed out, when the son reaches, or even the daughter, whenever the child reaches that puberty and that teen age, because of the hormonal changes, there's certain behavioral changes in them. A lot of people frown upon these behaviors. So when they notice their son looking at the opposite sex and, you know, probably staring, they get upset that, oh my God, my son, you know, he's getting carried away. Or if a girl is getting attracted towards a good-looking boy. But this is natural. This is a natural process. Now, there are ways to manage this scenario.
Let's scrap these scenarios after a quick break.
All right, great. Let's come back and discuss them.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Sheikh, we were talking about how parents, they should manage this life phase of the teenagers when they start to develop feelings and are attracted just generally to the opposite gender.
Correct. We were mentioning about different scenarios or different possible methodologies that can be used to manage this kind of a situation.
Right.
First and foremost, I would like to point this out, that when a person is idle and he doesn't have enough work or task at his hand, this is when he gets this extra spare time to sit and think.
Which is very dangerous.
Which is superbly dangerous. And we have riwayats.
Many
in this
narrations
matter.
That are prohibiting, I would say, do not be idle, especially for youngers.
Especially when you're in that stage, teenage, where all your hormones are on, you know, steroids and
overdrive,
going crazy.
Completely,
They're working hard. They're doing overtime, all your hormones.
Right.
And at this time, if your child is sitting idle and does not have tasks at hand.
And alone.
And
especially
alone?
their own bedrooms, their own telephone device, their own
exactly.
laptop.
Exactly. This is another point that we're going to discuss in our subsequent episodes about having their own personal rooms and having
yes.
their own personal devices. Inshallah, we'll talk about that.
Inshallah.
But here, sitting idle is going to leave their mind empty. And this is where they start thinking. And when they start thinking, it leads them towards those thoughts
leads
about
to
the opposite
thoughts,
sex.
And then actions. And
exactly. So what do we do? Is one of the methods is not to let them be idle. Give them a task. Assign them tasks. Remember the age groups that we mentioned about. The first 7 years is the Sayyid, the
right.
kind of a...
Kind of the master.
The master of the
yeah.
house, or, you know, the explorer.
Yeah.
And then the second one was Abd, meaning
the servant.
Slave, the servant. And the
yes.
third one was Wazir.
The now, minister or
exactly.
the
so
confidant.
Now when this teenage starts off, and the child is at 14 years old, he's, according to the traditions, he's at that age of Wazir, meaning that he's now ready to accept tasks from you. Delegate
right.
tasks to him.
Responsibilities.
Give him responsibilities. Tell him, shopping in your hand, lawn mowing in your hand,
right.
Probably dishwashing in your hand. I don't know. Based on the gender that you have. You have
right.
a daughter, assign her the kind of
right.
things that she can take care of.
Outdoor work is generally for the
men,
the boys.
And
yeah.
the indoor work for the girls, you know,
right.
Washing clothes or whatever. But assign them. Don't think that, oh, she's just 14, you know, why should I...
She's
you know,
too young to learn to cook.
Exactly, and overburden her with tasks
right.
and all that. But if you're not doing that, then you're giving her a lot of extra free time
right.
to sit and ponder and think. And based on all the inputs that they're getting from the TV and from internet,
right.
from all the messages and the
even
Instagram
the foods
posts.
That we eat.
Everything, even on your packagings,
right.
different food
yeah.
that you... And all those go into your brain as, you know, subliminal messages to your subconscious mind.
Right.
And they contribute to what you think.
Of course, we should also mention that people who criticize some of these traditional ways of raising children, like teaching the daughters how to cook and the boys how to do outside work, how to go shop and buy stuff and do things, is a bad thing. But in reality, we are teaching them necessary life skills. We are investments.
Them, we're teaching them how to be self-sustaining, how to be self-sufficient, how to be confident
right.
and, you know, be independent in the future life.
In essence, yes. Sheikh, I would love to continue this discussion, but we are unfortunately out of time. I thank you for contributing to this discussion and also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any suggestions, feedback, or some comments, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. You can also find us on various social media websites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news, with delight.
How long could you work at your job? In Brazil, a 100-year-old man has broken the world record for the longest spell working at a single company. Walter Orthman has entered the Guinness World Record books for working at the same fabric company for an astonishing period of 84 years. He started on the factory floor before moving into administration and later on into the sales management. Despite his extraordinary accomplishment, Orthman's advice for those looking for a long and fulfilling professional life is surprisingly routine.
You have to like to work. I started to work with that willingness and fighting spirit. You also have to start working on something you like to do. You can't just do any job to say that you're working. That doesn't work. You're not going to be able to stand it. You have to look for a job that you like to do. And there, you won't even feel the time passing. That's what happened with me. I started working here, and I liked it. I worked my way up from point to point until I got to the position I'm in today.
Ortman says his secret to a long life and breaking the record is having a healthy lifestyle and staying away from junk food. He says he avoids sugar and salt as much as possible and tries to keep a diet that is healthy for the mind and soul. In order to stay sharp, Ortman says he does stretches and maintains physical activity.
Iran's National Museum is displaying a collection of artifacts that was stolen decades ago but has finally returned home after a long legal battle. The items, which include sacred figurines, pots and jars, date back to more than 3,000 years ago. They were stolen and sent to the West more than four decades ago. In 1991, the British Museum was seeking to buy the collection from a smuggler residing in Switzerland. The objects, however, were seized by Swiss police and revealed in court in 2008. Since then, Iran had been trying to get the stolen treasures back home.
Under pressure from the Iranian diplomatic apparatus and the official complaints of the National Museum in 2015, the legal process continued, and finally on December 20th, 2020, the collection returned to us.
The collection belongs to the northwestern city of Bukhan, which was the home of Manians around the 10th to 7th centuries BC. The Manians were one of the first nomadic tribes to build cities in that area. The director of Iran's National Museum says the effort to recover other stolen artifacts continues. The country is now holding talks with the US and Australia to return ancient objects smuggled over there. Agriculture is no exception when it comes to adapting new technologies in the context of changing climate. Now, French farmers in the northwestern suburbs of Paris grow greens in any season using hydroponic farms. Residents of a housing estate have ditched the traditional way of farming to create jobs for their community. Hydroponic farming is a method of growing plants in water, not in soil. It may sound like it would be a complicated process, but it's actually quite straightforward. The system is made of plastic and uses a rich organic ecosystem. The workers use less water than usual and do not even need a teaspoon of soil. One of the employees describes how they turned barren land into a farm.
It used to be a garage where they stored cars, but since there were no more cars, we used it as a dormitory. We listened to music and watched football matches. We used to meet here to have a bit of privacy and breathe, to hide away for a while. But now that it's become a place of work, I'm happy because I'm working.
Hydroponic farms can be used to grow products of all kinds in any region. In this one, farmers are planting all sorts of things, ranging from Peruvian mint to Vietnamese coriander. They hope that the system can be used to help local residents, especially those who need it the most. Magic returns to Belgium with a purple carpet of bluebells covering the undergrowth of Hallerbos woods near Brussels. Each spring, this beech forest turns into a bluebell spectacular, turning the area into a natural wonderland. Millions of these blooming flowers sprout up across the 550-hectare woods, filling the air with their sweet aroma. The short but enchanting blooming phase offers nature enthusiasts a one-of-a-kind experience.
It is an outstanding and magical place because whenever we come, there's an amazing atmosphere. The sunrise was truly beautiful this morning, and we know this offers the opportunity to take great photos and decorate our house. It is a great comfort during these tough times.
Visitors can stroll the winding paths and watch rabbits and deer wandering through the woods. The forest floor blooms for a period of 7 to 10 days. After this time, leaves begin to grow on the trees above them, blocking the sunlight from reaching the flowers. The phenomenon of bluebell forest is not uncommon in Europe, but the Hallerbus greenery is unique for the density and beauty of its blossoms. A huge pink moon has glowed over Chilean skies, mesmerizing stargazers and ordinary citizens alike. The full moon was completely visible over the capital, Santiago. The celestial phenomenon is called a pink moon as it appears in April and is named after an American plant, pink plot, that blooms in spring. The pink moon will shine during the weekend through early Monday and may be visible in most parts of the world. The phenomenon also marks the calendar for different religious festivities around the globe.
A batch of autonomous delivery vehicles has been provided to facilitate personnel and volunteers in the streets and communities of Shanghai. The self-driving vehicles distribute supplies to residents in the Chinese megacity, which is now hit hard by the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. The vehicles reduce person-to-person contact and largely lower the risk of infection. A community served by the distribution station has more than 30 apartment buildings and nearly 3,000 residents. The weight of each order is more than 5 kilograms, which puts great pressure on the volunteers to deliver. 49 autonomous delivery vehicles have been sent to communities, colleges, and hospitals in Shanghai to support anti-pandemic and supply work.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Sunny skies and spring temperatures made for the perfect setting for the 65th birthday of Fatu, the world's oldest gorilla living at Berlin Zoo. At this age, the Western Lowland gorilla is what Berlin Zoo calls almost something of a legend. Gorillas living in the wild have a life expectancy of about 40 years, and at 65, she has been the world's oldest living gorilla for a while. 65 is absolutely extraordinary, and that obviously needs to be celebrated in style.
They mainly get vegetables, and the sugar they receive at most is fruit sugar, and that's what we should suffer today in the shape of raspberries and blueberries. They were the decoration on rice cake made of boiled rice, a thin layer of rice and some curd so it sticks together. The bottom was made of a lot of green stuff, then the lion and lettuce.
According to Berlin Zoo, Western Lowland gorillas are now an endangered species after their natural habitat was continuously decimated, and therefore fewer and fewer animals live in the tropical rainforest of Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Gabon, and the Republic of Congo. The World of Opera is opening its doors to the deaf community for the very first time. The Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra has teamed up with the Deaf West Theater to stage a production of Beethoven's only opera, Fidelio, at their home at the Walt Disney Hall. The chorus will be performed by the White Hands Choir, a group from Venezuela consisting of disabled children and young adults who sing as well as sign. The production pairs up a singer and a deaf actor to both inhabit the one role on stage. Having deaf actors perform alongside opera singers, however, has its challenges, not least of which is keeping up the rhythm of the music.
I think probably there's a lot of tempo that